We are going to launch right into this very last masterclass of 2020. How good is it to say that some of these things in 2020 are coming to an end? And before I do that, I just want to take a look at our chat box and be sure that some of you at least are able to see and hear. And Vermont is here in Denver. From Fernie, BC, Hermosa Beach, New Jersey, Houston, Texas, Missouri, Minnesota. And Salt Lake City. People already have a drink and a pen and listening and watching from Pennsylvania. From Dallas, Mount Holly, hey Cindy, Tennessee, Palm Beach Gardens, Delano, California, Canada, South Carolina, Ohio, Virginia, Victoria, Fort Frances, Ontario, Kentucky, Venice, Montreal. Canada is really in the house tonight. Thanks so much. Georgia, Beaverton, Oregon, Chicago, Winnipeg, again. Wow. Okay, you should already have it, Carla. You should have gotten it this morning in an email. So check your inbox for that this morning. If you didn't check your emails, I'm not sure what time in the morning that went out, but I would look through your spam and your trash if it's something that you didn't receive. BC, Canada, Phoenix, New York. Interesting. Signed up this morning. Okay. I'm stumped a little bit. You might want to reach out to support. They may be able to help you while I'm in session. I can't help you. Hey, Sherry. Boston, San Francisco, Carla. Okay, gotcha. Toronto. Okay, awesome. And Lori, hello. Edmonds, Washington. So let's rock and roll. Literally, I'm going to talk speed dial talk, and I'm going to give you a spoiler alert right now. Really, the optimism is ours. We should be very excited about the possibilities of aging very well. We're in control. There are things we can definitely do, and yet we have had a wake-up call. I mean, would you agree with that? More than once in 2020. But the research that I'm sharing, these are 12, literally 12 slides of studies. There are several of them have multiples. So they're really 14 very pay attention to these studies to call attention to. But you're going to feel like there's 12 because literally visibly either in your notebook and or here in the slides, you've got 12 to focus on. Some of them duplicate. Actually, some of them have gone back to several of the same studies, and that often happens when, say, there's a, you know, a pool of researchers, or, you know, in your small town, all the elementary school teachers tend to be friends, right? All the second grade and third grade teachers tend to be friends. Well, it's very much the same with researchers. They play in the same sandbox, and so they often will report on a study about one concept, but then that same study will end up showing up in another published research article for a different angle. So you'll see a little bit of that here, but we're going to go ahead and dive in. I tried to pick very well-rounded pieces, so we weren't overlapping, but you will see a common theme here. I'm almost sure of it. I'll review that with you. So first of all, the playbook, you should have it. If you register later today, it went out this morning, so I'm not sure how the team handled that, quite honestly. I'm wondering how they handled that. But let me know if you don't have it. We'll make sure you do get it. Grab a pen no matter what. Add your questions anytime you want to the question box. That's the same place where you told me, like Katie said, she's from Colorado, so I'm jealous. And if you ordered the playbook, you should get it. If you ordered before this morning, it came out in the email this morning that you got. If you didn't order it, you didn't get it. So hopefully that makes sense. It's not too late if you decide you want to go back and get it after tonight. So we're going to call this the 12 Ways of Fitness in Menopause, which is the 2020 version. And this is year number 8 for delivering this keynoter. So this is me. I'm guessing you landed here because you already know. So I'm not going to dwell on this very much. But whether it's me or it's anybody else, you know, what I really advise you to do is make sure that who you're following has the information on you reaching where it is that you want to go based on where you are right now. And please, you know, be sure that you're putting anybody to the test, including me. Scrutinize their education, their qualifications, and certainly their experience level. It's very easy for a trainer to answer, I've got 20 years of experience, but fail to tell you they have trained for 2 or 3 hours a week during that time. That's very different than somebody who's all day, every day. That's been their key focus. So think about the questions you ask very carefully. All right, let's dive in. I'm going to give you the cliff notes and I'm going to elaborate on that verbally. So number one, the very first study involves COVID-19. We are all subject to that. My interpretation also layers in, what does that mean for a woman in menopause because of what's happening there as well? So here we go. Restrictions occurred on parks, on our outdoor play, as well as indoor play, live classes, gyms. You know, we all have made various kinds of choices to mask or not mask, to stay safe, to avoid travel, either for ourselves or to protect loved ones. And there's probably been an increased stress level for any one of us, whether or not we've felt it or outwardly can call on it. There's a layer of ambiguity of not knowing the future quite as much as we would like to believe we did before COVID. There happens to be accelerated muscle loss in late perimenopause and early postmenopause. Now, that accelerated loss simply resumes a normal loss when you're either pre-menopause, there's still an aging feast that was in play, and then you're post-menopause. So you're 3 or 5 years beyond hitting menopause. Your acceleration slows back down. You're still losing easier than you're gaining lean muscle without the correct things in place to offset it. Medications that any of us might be on can also add to complications of gaining lean muscle mass and or causing us to gain fat. So super important that you consider that. And for anyone who needed some support with sleep, with depression or anxiety during this time, medications can also complicate. So what do we do about it? Knowing with less activity, the less physically active you are, the less likely you are to be increasing or enhancing your lean muscle tissue. And if you also are a female who's here and listening, you are at accelerated losses, potentially if you're in that very special window. So number one, right now, if you still have room on your Christmas wish list or your Christmas gift list for someone in your family who literally you will benefit from it, a smart scale that measures body composition is probably one of the best investments you'll make. This one is one of the more top of the line. It's about $350. You can get other smart scales from a range from anywhere from $25 to about $75 or $125. And again, it's like shopping for cars, right? It depends. Do you want the luxury one that's a little bit more dependable, that's not going to break down, that has the ideal warranty? Or are you willing to go with, hey, I want something that's drivable. I want something that will give me a measurable benchmark. But eventually, you know, when things open up, I am going to go back to the gym and I will have access to something else. You know, make your own decision, but it should have your body composition. That's telling you how much muscle weight you have, how much body fat percent you have. It's not BMI. BMI is body mass index. You and I can calculate that by knowing your height and your weight. That tells you nothing about whether that weight is fat weight, which is not metabolically active, or it's muscle, which will keep you from being frail and falling. So strength training to muscular fatigue twice a week, doing interval training two or three times a week max, at least one would be ideal for everybody. You know, not ideally doing it back to back, eating 30 plus grams, at least 30 grams of protein at three meals a day, and check for amino acid profile. So if you're eating from a plant-based source, or one that is a collagen-based source, you've got to do some combining to actually maximize. So when I give you smoothie recipes, smoothie bowl recipes, some of those toppings and ingredients are not random. Those are on purpose because nuts and seeds, for instance, together with a pea-based protein, it starts out pea-based is a whole complete protein. However, it's lower in certain amino acids. So if we can bump that up by what else you take in at that meal, or at least in the day, and it's easier to accomplish that at the meal and know it, check that box, that's why it's there. So you've got to be a little bit wiser with how you eat your meals than we did maybe 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. Target your ideal weight in pounds and grams of protein that you take in daily. But again, it's not the total at the end of the day. You need to take in 30 plus at each meal in order to reach the best absorption of those essential amino acids. Too little, it doesn't work. Too much, you don't get more, it gets stored as fat. You want to eat a diet that's rich in whole foods and not processed foods. If it's got a barcode on it, it's probably not ideal. Try to move every day. We're doing right now the 29 walks, in December. It's a simple, simple challenge. I'm doing it social media wide, doing it for people in and out of our membership because it's easy to walk. And you can walk indoors if you have to walk because it's too cold, too snowy, too something. But getting outside even for 5 or 10 minutes can make a significant difference in your health. And for postmenopause women, we'll come to a study that tells you this. It actually can help you with weight control significantly more. And consider a supplement with betaine HCL and added digestive enzymes to help you break down the protein that you eat. Many times women are avoiding eating more protein because they're feeling too bloated, too full, or it's too hard to digest. That is in part because we don't have as much stomach acid, which is betaine HCL. So consider starting to take some before each meal, especially each full meal. So I'm not talking a little snack, but literally when you sit down to a meal or enjoying a meal, you need to do that. That scale, by the way, is in the gift guide. If you don't already have it, the link is there. Okay, so there we have it. Number one. Number two, really almost a domino effect. So this is about immunity. Also a hot topic in 2020, right? But how does exercise and immunity and menopause give you a triple play? What's the interaction here? So what we know about exercise and immunity is that there's a sweet spot. So if you're exercising too little, you actually are not helping yourself enough with your immunity. You've got to actually give yourself some stimulus. You've got to increase your core temperature. You've got to be, breaking a sweat and having your core temperature elevated enough for that to happen. You've got to be changing what's happening inside. So there needs to be sufficient intensity, and there also, though, has to be adequate recovery. If you're exercising day after day after day, no break, it's not harder some days, easier others, day off, it's not moderate some, you're probably doing way too much, and potentially you already know that because you're way too exhausted and you're thinking, I'm not getting any results. When your body is inflamed because it doesn't have a chance to recover, that's what will happen. but both too high intensity too frequently and too little movement or too infrequently moving fail you. So the intensity is this. It can come from volume, meaning if you're trying to do something every single day, and I don't mean moving. Walking, by the way, is movement. We all need movement, but we've begun to think in 2020 for some reason that walking is exercise. It is not. It is simply something we're doing because we sit all day otherwise. Unless you have a job that's very, very active and you're an anomaly, then potentially you actually don't need to be walking quite as much as you are for the additional piece. But that can come from volume. Intensity can come from duration. So if you're doing more than 60 or 75 minutes, an hour, hour and 15 minutes, it's getting too long. It becomes very intense. And speed is one way of adding intensity. Exceedingly heavy weight is also intense. So think about that. And here's what I'd advise you to do. Throw out the everything in moderation term that we learned so well growing up. And exercise in moderation is actually not what you're after. What you want and what we know now. So there's a hangover effect from about late 80s and early 90s that says you should exercise at a moderate level. No, actually, that's not true. The best thing for immunity has been shown to be moderate amounts of high intensity and low intensity. There's what we call no benefits zone, and that happens to be in the middle, where you just let your heart rate drift up there and you're just overdoing it, but you're not getting enough benefits either by doing low level that helps your cortisol level or high level that also helps your cortisol level. So here it is, putting that research into action for you. Again, that moderate amount of high and low intensity versus just moderate, washing it all over. Perform recommended 2 times a week strength training to fatigue. So we've already started to repeat that pattern, right? Give yourself 72 hours in between to rest and recover and emphasize your major muscle groups. So overall tone and muscle group movement versus doing a little baby bicep curl with a little muscle group that is too is small to make a huge impact on your overall body. Now, it can be a part of it, but it needs to be later in your workout, and you want to focus on things like chest press, bent over row, squats and lunges, those kinds of things. And if you can't do squats and lunges, you can do other things that stimulate those large muscle groups from the floor. It still works. So think about 45 minutes maximum of high intensity interval training per week. That's about where the injury rate starts to increase dramatically. So the spike goes up at that point. And for women in midlife, that's really important to remember because for some reason, we don't know the scientific exact connection. We know there's a correlation between midlife hormonal changes and plantar fasciitis, carpal tunnel, tendonitis. We don't know exactly what it is. And it doesn't mean that it's bound to happen unless you think that way and you will bring it on yourself. It's not. So if you exercise safely, wisely, smartly, you're doing everything lifestyle change wise to manage your hormones and to exercise appropriately, none of those things has to happen to you. You may have had it happen, but these are chronic problems, but they should not last chronically. So you should cure them and be able to move on. But those injuries will occur at more frequent rates if you overdo high intensity interval training. And, you know, use protocols that are inclusive of the rest for muscle groups specific to women in midlife. And what I mean by that is you really can't walk into a class where you see men and women both of all ages. And I know that's fun. I know it actually works. And I know that I say it's not about age, it's about your ability. But before you go into a group like that, you want to know you. You want to know your personal need and how you modify anything and a protocol. So we need more rest between sessions and often between your sets and sometimes even between repetitions in a set. Okay, the third study is all about muscle, and really it's muscle and menopause, but this will go into and spill over into protein because we cannot build muscle without adequate protein. The building block of muscle is protein and the essential amino acids in a complete protein. Loss of muscle creates devastating disabilities in older women. And if during the pandemic we're exercising at home and we're doing toning exercises with small pink dumbbells or tubing and we're not reaching muscular fatigue, we are putting ourselves at risk for muscle losses. Not that just will happen right now, but that will devastatingly impact you in 10 and 20 and 30 years. So you've got to think really hard about, what am I doing for my future right now? How am I investing in my future with my exercise? Our muscle losses begin at 30. And each decade, we can lose anywhere from 8 to 10% of our muscle unless you've been lifting weights adequately during that time, which is a wise investment. And muscle protein synthesis drops or declines as we age. And that requires optimal strength training to offset it, because actually strength training helps you or supports your muscle protein synthesis. It brings it back again. Doesn't quite get you all the way back to where you were 10 or 20 years ago, but it definitely improves it. And then protein timing to overcome that protein synthesis also helps. So we have a little bit of a blunting effect on our ability to synthesize protein immediately after exercise. So if you wait about 60 minutes, you'll actually have a better muscle protein synthesis from a high protein meal after you have lifted weights particularly. But after you're doing any intense exercise, it pays off if you can time that correctly. So putting all of that in motion, in part, we're already there, already talking about it. But number one, are you resistance training? If you're not, start. And add high quality protein, the timing matters so that you can optimize that post-workout increase in protein synthesis. And for about the next 24 hours, after a good intense workout, strength training to muscular fatigue, maybe doing high intensity interval training, slight lesser effect, but still some, you have about a 24-hour period afterward where your body is still repairing, rebuilding micro tears in your muscles, and you can use that protein to your benefit. So if you're only paying attention to that one meal afterward and then you're kind of skimping on your protein the rest of the day, you can kind of be shooting yourself in the foot. That exercise can't take, right? You can't get the full benefit of it unless you've got the protein to support it. You also want to avoid excess endurance exercise. And I know you may love it. I'm an endurance girl myself, but excess endurance exercise actually increases muscle breakdown. So if you're noticing I'm doing lots and lots of exercise, but I'm not losing weight, it potentially is because you're doing lots and lots of exercise. Back off, decrease that inflammation. Okay, so coming up, I am going to tell you later about the opening of Stronger, our 12-week program. And typically we are advertising this to Stronger One, the very first 12-week Stronger program that I designed. And this time, for the first time ever, Stronger Three is available outside of our cafe membership. So if you're not strength training, I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about that toward the end. So stay tuned. Number four on the studies, this is one of the only ones that really specifically talks about nutrition. But it was such an interesting study that I want to add this here. And especially for those of you who are thinking, I eat extremely healthy. I do my green smoothies. I'm eating lots of vegetables, lots of salads, and not making any progress. It may be worth looking at more than one thing, but this is certainly one you can test very easily for yourself. So sometimes it can have to do with the oxalates in green vegetables, and it's abundant in green leafy vegetables. So if you're putting, say, a handful of smooth herbs, a handful of spinach in your smoothies or more than that, and then you're having kale or hopefully not spinach again, because you can overdo spinach. It can be toxic. You're not going to feel it necessarily, but it can accumulate certain things in your body. So you want to rotate your greens. But then you're having salads and maybe you have another more greens at night. You may be overdoing the greens. And there were some interactions of green leafy vegetables and citrus fruits specifically. So pulling out citrus, not other things, compared to apples, for instance. Apples didn't have the same negative effect. But in a study of a certain group of women who were in midlife, a large enough cohort that we should probably pay attention, symptoms and signs of menopause, like hot flashes, night sweats, the ones we all recognize, were greater in those women who were doing a lot of leafy green vegetables and a lot of citrus fruits. So it may be worth swapping that out. So yes, increase your vegetable intake, and to a limited amount fruit. We much prefer vegetables for a lower sugar content. But if you're symptomatic, you've got lots of symptoms, hot flashes, night sweats, weight gain, aches, pains, substitute non-starchy vegetables for your leafy greens. So go for the broccoli and the carrots and the cauliflower, the green beans, the Brussels sprouts. Go for other things. So not sweet potatoes, those types of things, non-starchy options. And fill your plate with those kinds of things as opposed to salads. If you still like vegetables in your smoothies, try cucumbers and celery. Temporarily try putting in fresh herbs like cilantro if you tolerate that. Not everybody does. And look at whether that makes a change for you. You can also literally do a food sensitivity test. But if that describes you and you would say, literally, I'm, eating tons of salads and I'm having lots of green smoothies and I'm not getting anywhere, you might want to look at that. That might be a food sensitivity or a trigger for you. So consider that. And if you have done an elimination diet, by the way, this is just in general, good information to know. And that is, don't forget to reintroduce. There are a lot of women who will go through an elimination diet and I say, I feel so good. I don't want to reintroduce those things. But truly, ultimately, we'll fall back. We'll settle into our old lives little by little. And if you test, you will be far less likely to do that if you're troubled by a food. And you also will be far less likely to do it if you reintroduce that food and you have no problem with it, but you can then control and rotate that food in and out every few days so it doesn't become a problem for you either. But if you skip a whole lot of foods that you've eliminated from those, let's eliminate gluten and wheat and dairy and soy, all of those things combined eliminate a big source of micronutrients. That's not the goal. The goal is to find out what's happening with your gut right now and just rotate those foods in and out so you get a diverse group of micronutrients in your body at any specific day without causing a lot of problems or disruption. Okay, sarcopenia. So sarcopenia is muscle loss. So let me be clear, and just in case you were confused, we've talked about muscle loss and the benefit of physical activity for it, but this is related directly to muscle loss or significant muscle loss and HRT, so hormone replacement therapy. when you have changed it all, you've done everything that you can control and yet nothing has worked, hormone replacement therapy, if in your life it feels like this is an option for me, you may want to then look at it. So in a very recent podcast with Dr. Lindsay Berkson. So if you go to the podcast page on Flipping 50, just use the search tab or the search icon and type in Dr. Lindsay Berkson. And we talk about the myths and the old carryover thought process that hormone replacement for anybody who is at risk for breast cancer or has a history of breast cancer, you absolutely can't do it. And there's some new thought to that. And she is kind of behind a big part of it. It will take some time, but many doctors are beginning to wake up and open up to the idea that maybe we've looked at this wrong and the studies actually don't point quite so clearly that it's not good. There may be more rewards than there are risks, but that's for those of you that feel like there's more risk or that you're not sure. And that's what you've heard too. Listen to this podcast. It'll give you some great insight. So this is not a persuasive argument for HRT, but this is simply relaying the research. So what changes can you make first? Lifting weights to the point of muscular fatigue twice a week with 72 hours between. This is not a repeat slide, by the way, but are you seeing a pattern here? Eating high quality protein to recover adequately. So at least 30 grams per 3 meals per day and at minimum 2 meals per day. So this comes from one study that said, you know, if you're not fitting that in, you can't do it. 2 is minimum. And that was targeted at, say, older women who are later in their 70s and 80s and 90s who just can't find the appetite to eat that much. But at least twice was much more doable for them and at least helped them not become more frail than they already were. But if you're really trying to thrive and you also want to be a very active woman and help yourself with strength training, 3 is probably much more ideal. And do that around the timing of your resistance training when possible. Assess your sleep quality and quantity. Prioritize that because you've got to have the right hormones in place that occur when you're sleeping well. Cortisol, namely, testosterone and growth hormone are 2 others. And if you're still experiencing a loss of muscle, and you may not call it frailty at this point, but that may be where you're headed, weakness, you're not progressing, hormone replacement may support your needs. We can't all do it with lifestyle habits. And if it feels like this is an option for me, I'm willing to consider that, then you have it. So there's no judgment on whether you choose yes or you choose no. But if you're not feeling yourself, you may find for your brain, your muscle, and your bones and longevity potentially may all benefit from that. So in that last statement, by the way, I don't want to pass that too quickly. You know, if it's been 10 years, you know, or less than 10 years since you hit menopause, you're probably a better candidate. I know someone recently asked me and said, you know, I'm 70, you know, is that too late? Or I'm 68. And it depends, actually. You know, if you reached menopause and still it's within about 10 years, not necessarily. Okay, so let's talk about HIIT, high intensity interval training. And HIIT's going to come up a couple of times in upcoming studies for different reasons, very interestingly. So I'll give you a spoiler alert here. HIIT's going to be beneficial to you for the rest of your life for various reasons. So when we looked at menopause specifically, this year, spinning intervals were more effective than running intervals. And I know somebody out there is cheering loudly, right? Saying, I don't run anyway. And lasting more than 8 weeks is more effective than just 8. And that was basically the researchers saying that when they conducted studies of just 8 weeks, there were changes enough to say this is significant. But clearly, I say this for you, you don't want to enter into anything that you think, okay, after 8 weeks, I'm done. You know, then the wedding happens and forget it, right? You hopefully are starting a program for 8 weeks, or in the case of Stronger, for 12, to start for the rest of your life, right? To have the benefits for the rest of your life. Combined with resistance training to fatigue made more results. But I want to point this out. So when I say combined with resistance training, this doesn't mean, this is interesting, we were talking about this on a podcast today, that say in the spinning, they weren't doing push-ups on the bike handlebars or taking pink dumbbells and lifting them over their shoulders. We were both complaining about that today. How ridiculous. Anyway, but we're not talking also about the types of boot camps where you might run back and forth from here to the end of the room and then do a set of squats or a set of bench presses lying down on the floor and then go run again. We're not talking about mixing it up that way. That actually washes out the high intensity interval, and it washes out the ability to reach fatigue in that strength training, and you get lesser results with both. You're more or less moving more in a frenzy. You're not getting the best results from each of those. So what we're saying here is that doing spinning intervals or intervals of any kind together in your week, when you also will be doing two high quality strength training sessions, gets the best results. So you want to avoid combining those rapid movements, moving from one to the other. And if you're not familiar with AMRAAM or EMOM, those mean as many reps as possible. And it means every minute on the minute. And in other words, they turn you into someone who's competing with somebody next to you to see who can move the fastest, not who can do the highest quality movement and reach muscular fatigue, which is going to change your metabolism. We've got to do it right, not just do it. So to put this in motion for you, say yes to high intensity interval training. And it doesn't matter, you know, if you've got plantar fasciitis, you've got knee replacements, hip replacements, or you're headed that direction, there is some kind of way that you too can do high intensity interval training, whether that's in the pool. I know that's a little bit more of an obstacle for some of us during the pandemic, but it's possible. Or on a bike, on a rowing machine. Any mode of movement can be made to be high intensity. And if you're thinking, I have no equipment, I'm in a 2x4 apartment, what do? You know, twice a week in our membership, we do high intensity interval training, and we do it with nothing, just on the floor. The way you put moves together and the way you put the effort in means results. So you can, with the right effort, get the right intensity. You're always going to weigh the risk reward ratio for you. Higher impact, there's going to be higher risk. Repeated activity, meaning, you know, if you worked a job like a hairdresser, you know, and you were repeatedly doing the same thing over and over, a lot of hairdressers end up getting arthritis in their hands or problems with their shoulders or elbows because they're always holding them up. And they're always often doing things on one side, more so potentially than the rest of us. And the same is true of your exercise. You don't want that, you know, repeated syndrome of doing the same movement all the time. So getting variety is very important. And say yes to separate resistance training. Don't combine your resistance and your HIIT in your same workout. And by that, I don't mean you couldn't do like 20 minutes of your interval training and then follow that with 20 minutes of resistance training. That would be fine. It's just don't go back and forth between let's do 2 minutes and then let's do a strength training exercise. Let's do 2 more minutes and let's do a strength training. That is counterproductive. Okay, let's talk low intensity for a minute, because if you are in postmenopause, you want to rethink low intensity exercise, and here's why. And I say this specifically to those of you who are in postmenopause, and I say rethink because often in perimenopause, the stages where at first we don't even know really that we are in perimenopause when hormones begin to change, unless you have a dramatic weight gain or you have a dramatic shift in belly fat right away, visible cellulite becomes an issue, the sleep, insomnia becomes an issue. And there aren't those huge slap in the face things. Later, you may experience some of those, but early stages of perimenopause, you may begin to just notice that creep. And when you do, and you notice that, okay, now I'm gaining weight, I do have these issues, and nothing I do seems to work anymore. If you can say that, then potentially you've realized that it doesn't matter if I work harder or I work, you know, lower, if I do less or I do more, it doesn't matter. If you've gotten to that point, a lot of us have, you know, ideally and wisely, I will say this, minimized, and you're just doing the highest priority thing. Hopefully that is small amounts of HIIT, small amounts of strength training, just to kind of cope and avoid muscle losses. But postmenopausal women can actually help control their weight even more by adding back in low level, low to moderate level walking. And that is what I referred to at the very beginning as, this is an exercise. This is not your workout, but going for frequent walks daily, that 29 walks we're doing this month, all fits in. And that added movement can significantly add up. It's supporting you in decreasing cortisol levels and helping to optimize insulin. And the two together, cortisol and insulin, do a lot to either decide, do we store or do we burn fat? So putting that in motion during perimenopause, do focus. It is okay to cut back, because while those hormones are kind of really coming down and plummeting, although they are still on a roller coaster up and down, and it's not necessarily predictable, you want to maintain your HIIT. You want to maintain that strength training for bone and muscle and for avoiding your metabolism drops while you're there. And you may need otherwise, for fatigue reasons, to decrease what else you're doing. Nothing wrong with that. And, you know, according to your fatigue, you know, long, slow, low intensity, moderate exercise is okay. But decide, you know, is this making me better or more tired? And then in menopause or post, when you hit menopause, continue to do those activities, but add back in some of that low level, low to moderate activity level. And that may significantly change your strength, your body composition. And I will just vouch for a lot of women who are in our membership, our cafe, who will tell me that, you know, we did a lot of live workouts together, supporting them, connecting early in COVID, and we still do two a week. But also encouraging, you know, walks and other things in between. And because of COVID, because we hit a point where there's change, there's a need for change, there often then will be the need to be sure that you're getting adequate exercise and movement to negate stress. And a lot of our cafe members noticed they're in better shape, you know, by July. And that's, you know, something to think about. So it didn't take more exercise. It took more movement, right? Okay, time flies. So HIIT comes up again here. And this statement is really about women in menopause specifically. And it really raised a lot of eyebrows among the researchers, to tell you the truth. So it's a December 2020 study in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning. And it proved what you may already know. If you already love high intensity interval training, the higher intensity the workouts were, the shorter duration you perceive it to be. Time flies. And so we're looking at a picture of someone boxing, and obviously they've got a sparring partner, which there's no mask, right? So we know this is not an accurate and up-to-date picture, and you don't need a partner. You don't need the gloves, honestly. But the point being, when you're distracted and you're thinking 30 seconds, I've got to go, and then I'm in recovery, and then 30 seconds, I'm going to go again. Your brain just doesn't really have time to register how much time left in this workout, you know, or how much time have I been exercising in this workout. It's just flying, because all you really focus on is the 30 seconds you're in and working as hard as you can during that time. And there's a change in the perception of it. So compared to, you know, going out the door and doing 45 minutes of a run, or doing 30 minutes of interval training versus just a steady state, you know, go out, jog it. The high intensity interval training, time flies. You didn't notice you were exercising. So putting it in motion. If right now you're doing a lot of just straight, I'm doing the high or the kind of go out the door and I keep it at the same level, substitute one interval training day for a different kind of cardio in your week to start, and doing 10 minutes of those intervals, meaning a minute of hard and a minute of easy. That's 2 minutes right there. So we count it off. Progress, so you're doing two different interval training days. So maybe Monday and Friday you're doing those. And then maybe you progress to doing those for 15 minutes each, or to 20, or instead of upping it to 20 minutes, you do three of them, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for 15 minutes each. So starting with less work and more recovery is a good way to progress your intervals, meaning there's 30 seconds of work, but there's a minute or minute and a half of recovery time. The next progression is 1-to-1, 1 minute to 1 minute, for instance. And then last but not least is only then do you progress to doing, say, you do 30 seconds of high intensity interval training and you do 10 seconds of recovery. And I know that's not potentially what you get when you go into a class. You drop in and you get advanced unless you're controlling the environment yourself. So again, for HIIT, we're going to talk about post-menopause training effects. So again, with Journal of Physiology is where this one was published. This one is the not so good news. This is probably the one downer. The good news here is you have the opportunity to warn young women in your presence and your care that they need to get started sooner rather than later, exercising the right way. So capillaries, if you're looking at capillaries, the artery, the vein, kind of, this is a quick review of your heart health, right? But within your muscles, we also have these capillary beds, and these are where the blood gets delivered carrying oxygen. So oxygenated blood coming to those working muscles is required while you're exercising in order to exercise effectively. And the more fit you get, the more efficient you get at providing even more. And you lay down more of these capillary beds, the more fit you are. So if you've ever seen the calves or the lower legs of, say, a marathon runner or someone who does Ironman triathlon, specifically, endurance trainers are known for this. Strength trainers have it a bit, but endurance trained athletes often have it quite significantly more. You will notice that you can literally see the vascularity in their legs, in their muscles. And that is in part because they're essentially very good at delivering oxygen to those working muscles. The problem is that even though women in menopause respond exceptionally well and surprise researchers by working at a level of 80% of their maximum heart rate, when some of the researchers didn't even admit it before, but would say, we were surprised that they could actually do it, as if we're all washed up and that is it, it's all over, game over. But even though the women in the study worked at 80% or higher, which is, this is a place where you're breathless, generally at 85%, you'd be really getting uncomfortable. But our capillaries don't respond in the way men's or younger women's do. So we don't respond by setting down those same capillaries anymore. Now, there haven't been very many studies in women who were, say, in their 70s or 80s, way post-menopause. These were women who were, you know, just post-menopause. So I'm not sure if the change, you know, is temporary or if it starts then, and that's simply the way it is. But that means that you're doing the work, you're still making strides, you're getting benefits in terms of muscle and getting benefits in your VO2, the ability to carry oxygen, and your heart's ability to pump more blood each stroke, but we're not getting that capillary bed down, delivering more oxygen to muscle. So we're not necessarily gaining more comfort. We're still out of breath. We still don't benefit as much as we would have with the training effect. So what you want to know is, you wish you would have known that you'd start earlier. So be sure here that, first of all, you know, it's not lower intensity. We do not need to lower our intensity because we're in menopause. And I may have told some of you this. I told, I think, our cafe members last week that I was interviewed by a journalist last week. And she asked leading questions, and twice, both on the initial and on the follow-up. And it was about, you know, what are some signs and symptoms that people need to slow down in their exercise after 40? And I said, well, wait a minute. I said, what kind of an article are you writing? I mean, is that how you're wanting to write it? Or do you want the truth? And I said, because I don't actually see that in my practice. I don't actually believe that. And, you know, that's not really what's happening. There's a greater need for recovery between exercise, but they can work just as hard. So, and I still believe that for you as well. So pay attention to not it being lower intensity for you. There's not a need for lower intensity. Adding more lower intensity movement is a good idea, and adding more recovery is important. But you do not need to do less intensity. In fact, if you're not doing any, you need to start. So you can make it lower impact and easy to accelerate or increase your resistance. Those are the ways that you can turn up the intensity safely. So if you're on a bike, simply you pedal faster, or you shift the gear so that you're going against more resistance. In boxing, you can control it by going up with the arms, going down with the lower body, combining them. So there's plenty of variety, no over repetition use. Water exercise, another safe environment we've already mentioned, elliptical and rowing, where there's no impact. So getting younger in women involved sooner in their lives so that they've got more capillaries as they enter menopause, and they will have greater fitness as they go through it. And we'll tie that in later with a study coming up here. So walking is the preferred exercise mode of women in menopause, just by way of survey. What's appealing about walking to women is that generally programs that are about walking are sensitive to health realities of women in menopause, meaning if you have a condition or you have a joint issue, walking is often still very doable. There's inclusivity of various expectations and levels of fitness with a walking program. You can go at your own pace. It's even if you're doing it with other people, if you're at least in an area where you can circle and see each other, it's still very doable. There's attentiveness to the need for social support. Now, not so much true, but walking programs, as you see pictured here, and still within an app, you know, and many of you may be familiar with Peloton, you know, and the success that they've had really during the pandemic, maybe in part because of the pandemic, is they created a connection with other people that you know, maybe from around the world or your family across the country, but you can actually be competing or riding with them. And that level of camaraderie is really something that CrossFit originally capitalized. And like the program or not like the program, you've got to like the fact that that was a big piece of motivation and community about it that was very successful. So what is the problem with walking? And that is this, that, you know, I posted just the other day, never walk alone. And you've heard never swim alone. But in this case, never walk alone really means don't let that be your only mode of exercise. Because yes, walking is extremely healthy. But as I said, walking is walking. Walking is not necessarily exercise, not unless you are getting breathless, not unless you are literally hiking. So you're using some terrain changes and you're getting some steep hill walk in and charging up it so that you again are getting out of breath. You can make it interval training, but if you're not doing this, you need to start. And you also need strength training. You need resistance training and you need some mobility work. Walking is very linear. You're straight ahead and the sagittal plane is your only movement. We need to move laterally and we need to move with rotation as well. And we need all of those movements for just being functional in life. Think about rolling out of bed. You move in all three of those planes within 30 seconds of rising, actually within about five. So it means you need weight training, movement in all three planes, and you've got to have adequate intensity and mobility. Physical activity and fitness. No surprise that your physical activity goes up, your fitness level goes up. But what happens to those in relation to menopause? As physical activity goes up, menopause symptoms go down, whether we're talking somatic symptoms or urogenital symptoms. So your somatic symptoms, we're talking like hot flashes, the night sweats, the weight gain, as VO2, and that is your ability again to deliver oxygen, goes up, urogenital symptoms go down. And by that, we're talking incontinence. We can be talking about dryness, lack of libido, pain during sex. As WHR, your resting heart rate improves, symptoms go down. So I'm sorry, your waist to hip ratio improves, your symptoms go down. So here's where that should be. So your waist to hip ratio 0.85 or less. So the way you measure that is take your waist measurement, take your hip measurement, divide waist by hip, get 0.85 or less for a woman, different for a man, and less than 35% in the waist is ideal. So if you're higher than those or even equal to those, we've got greater risk. And typically we'll see by 1 in 2. If your physical activity is up, probably your waist to hip ratio and your waistline are better. If your VO2 goes up, probably your fitness level is higher because you're very active. Your waist to hip ratio and your waist girth will benefit. As sitting time decreases, okay, somatic and psychological symptoms both improve. So again, those somatic are hot flashes, night sweats, migraines, headaches, those types of things. So both things start moving more. So both in terms of exercise, high intensity, and movement, both of them help. So again, apple to pear. So looking at where you store your weight. When we're younger, reproductive years, we tend to store our weight more in a pear shape. Hips are a little bit wider to accommodate, you know, a wide hip base, wide pelvis for birthing a baby. And we store fat there also related to carrying a baby. And that makes the waist slightly smaller. Shifting that weight after menopause typically starts to increase weight storage right around the waistline. So a little bit more of an apple shape, a little bit more like a man. So increasing overall exercise time and movement time both. Add intense exercise if you're not. Moderate to vigorous, reaching breathlessness. So that's intense intervals and high intensity interval training. So both kind of on the way up and up matter. So it's low level, then next level, and then ultimate. And then last but not least in studies is mental well-being. And, you know, we talk physically, and a lot of you may already just intuitively say, well, of course, if I exercise more, I'm going to feel mentally better. And some of you may equate exercising more to achieving weight loss or a body image that you feel better about, that being mental. And depending on where you are on your journey with fitness, I would encourage you to think about this in an open-minded way, because a lot of times as a fitness professional, really what I want to do is have you be codependent. So whether you start for the weight loss, you know, ultimately that's not why people stay. It is because of the mental change. It's because of the positive outlook. It's because there's a lift in mood. There may be improvements if you have depression or an anxiety. And so very important that we're closing with this, I think, in this year too, from pre-menopause. So that's no typo, pre-perimenopause. Okay. So before that even happens, to peri and post-menopause, there's an increased prevalence of feelings of depression. And association with depressive symptoms varies dramatically. It's very connected with physical activity in women in menopause. As physical activity goes up, signs and symptoms of depression go down. So exercise, moving more with a reasonable, realistic level commensurate with your signs and your symptoms. So very important. So thinking about how are you feeling now? And by that, I mean specifically, you know, depression or anxiety, both can bring fatigue, feelings of fatigue, sleeplessness, or cause it, which, you know, in a sense causes fatigue in itself. So exercise, but exercise appropriately, not pushing through necessarily, but also think of it as if you were taking a depression or an anxiety medication. You would know that that has to be in your bloodstream, taken on a regular basis in order to be doing you good. And exercise is medicine, is a trademark term by the American Medical Association and the American College of Sports Medicine. They have coined that term so that doctors actually can write prescriptions for exercise, because they've got so much more power and authority than anyone else is given in our society quite often. And it matters. But if you look at it the same way, you've got to have that dose on a regular basis also. You can't just sporadically try it, stop it, try it, stop it, or overdose or underdose. Okay, so if you were taking notes mentally or on paper, literally, the questions I would ask you for your own checklist would be this: strength frequently enough? Are you doing strength training frequently enough and not too frequently? And as you do strength training, are you doing it to muscular fatigue? Meaning at the end of a set, you really couldn't do one more without either cheating and having really poor form, or you couldn't complete the repetition because your arm is too tired or your body part's too tired. Are you doing strength isolated from your high intensity? It's not a boot camp kind of a class. It's your strength training or you're doing HIIT. Are you getting adequate recovery time between those exercises? So without that adequate recovery time, the older we get, the more breakdown we have when we exercise. And that's okay as long as we have the recovery time and activity like sleep and adequate calories and protein to compensate. Do you know what your priorities are? Are yours lean muscle, bone? Is it mood for you? Is it immunity for this year? And are you doing that kind of a priority-based exercise selection? And are you controlling for your injury and your risk? So looking at the risk and the reward ratio carefully. Doing HIIT and doing it up to 45 minutes a week. And by no means is that a quota. If you're just starting out, start with 10 or 15 minutes. See how that goes for a couple of weeks. Actually building up, if you do, to 45 minutes may take weeks and actually months. And are you varying the type and the movement that you do if you are doing HIIT? Strength training exercises that are functional, that impact your metabolism, versus that are creative. So this is probably a conversation we could have for an entire session, but this one is important that you're not thinking and following, say, a trainer who is only interested in doing functional movement. If you need metabolism boosting, you need to have a percentage of your workout achieve each of the different things that you might need. During midlife and beyond, we need, most of us, more lean muscle to continue to boost our metabolism or keep it high if it is there, and to boost our bone density. We do need mobility. We need to be able to move within a great range of motion. We need to be able to lift and flex and extend while we are rotating, because we do that getting out of the car with groceries or with small children, getting them out of cribs and bassinets, and, you know, being as playful with them as we want to be. All of those things will matter, but it's really important that you're looking at, are these movements matched to my specific goals and my needs at this moment? And there you have it. That's your checklist. If you'd like some more support, you know, and if you're just tell me what to do and I'll do it. If you're not specifically strength training, that's the real question today. The early bird special for the Flipping 50 Stronger program, this one is called Tone and Define. So each of the stronger programs, there are five, have a specific theme to them. So it might be basic training, it might be cellulite, it's tone and define in this case, might be build for lean muscle and metabolism. But tone and define, this one is a slightly lighter weight encouraged for a slightly higher repetition range, for perfect for those who are just starting, restarting, women who've been lifting for a long time and maybe lifting a little heavier but aren't seeing results. Often need to shake it up and come back down to pretty up that muscle by doing a little bit lighter weight and getting the definition out of the muscle that they have built. If you have a recent injury and or an illness and you're coming back off of that, lighter weight, a few more repetitions. So who is this great for? Somebody who wants lean muscle tissue, but prefers to do or needs to, based on any of the things I just mentioned, lighter weight. This is not ideal for bone density unless you're just beginning to strength train. Then it's a great start and a progression so that you'll get stronger and build a foundation. Ultimately, for bone density benefits, you'll be going a little bit heavier than this. But if you aren't yet there, this would be a good first step to then getting there safely over time. So it's twice weekly workouts. You get a quick start success guide so that you not only learn, okay, what are the philosophies? What are the things I need to keep in mind? What substitutes might I make if some exercises don't work for me? And how you can round out the strength training program that's included by adding your own walking or adding your own HIIT or mobility, stretching, and yoga exercises, and how they would fall with the plan of the strength training. Also talks you through how to optimally add protein at what time, not to forget that piece that's so very important for adding lean muscle mass. And optionally, the Flipping 50 journal being an addition to the program is also